Welcome, everybody, to the beginning of the fourth new year for our international MD support group. We now number 179 affiliates as of today, representing almost 3,000 previously unconnected people all over the world. We're also very happy to be launching our new telephone support group this month. That'll be next Thursday, welcoming about 30 people to our charter group and looking forward to including many more as the years go on. Your January newsletter is dedicated almost entirely to this month's topic of driving, and I hope you will have time to discuss the various articles in your groups. As I've written on page one, giving up our car keys is one of the most difficult changes we have to make in our lives. It does not, however, have to rob us of our independence. Dr. Penny Rosenblum will discuss this with us, along with ways to overcome the difficulties. Her talk includes making use of alternative transportation, understanding how low-vision rehabilitation services can help, and locating resources. As an addendum to Dr. Rosenblum's presentation, I've included articles in this newsletter that point to her main message. We can still stay in the driver's seat even if we no longer drive. And besides, when you think about the cost of owning and operating an automobile in today's economy, and when you think of the number of pedestrians, fire hydrants, and lampposts we're probably saving by not getting behind the wheel, why on earth would we even want to take the chance? We hope this month's session will help us sort out our feelings about the problem of turning over our keys and the practical issues that are surrounding it. By way of introduction of Dr. Rosenblum, she's an adjunct associate professor in the Department of Special Education, Rehabilitation, and School of Psychology at the University of Arizona, where she prepares teachers to work with children with visual impairment. She received her PhD from the same university in 1997. As a person with low vision, Dr. Rosenblum is able to share firsthand information with future teachers about the impact of visual impairment on the lives of children and adults. Since 2007, she's been working as a consultant with the American Foundation for the Blind. She's the co-author of Finding Wheels with Dr. Ann Korn. This curriculum is designed to assist adolescents with visual impairments to explore their options as non-drivers. With the staff at the American Printing House for the Blind, she produced the video Reclaiming Independence, Staying in the Driver's Seat When You No Longer Drive, and wrote the accompanying resource guide. We'll learn more about that video through her presentation today. Dr. Rosenblum has published in journals, has written book chapters, and has presented at many conferences within the United States and Canada. She's also presented workshops in several states on topics ranging from non-driving for individuals with visual impairments, social skills, Nemeth Code, and early literacy for Braille readers. Dr. Rosenblum, we're very happy to have you with us today. Ed Huggett is with us also, and he's going to be running the question and answer session at the end of your talk. We look forward to hearing what you have to say about this issue that has affected each and every one of us. Dr. Rosenblum?
It's a pleasure to be with you. Thank you very much for inviting me, Dan. The focus of my talk, as Dan explained, was about talking about this idea of reclaiming our independence when we're no longer able to drive. And actually, the title of a video that I'm going to share with you as we move through the presentation, Reclaiming Independence, Staying in the Driver's Seat When You No Longer Drive, is a product from the American Printing House for the Blind. And you affiliates were sent a copy of the flyer and ordering that has the ordering information for the video, and I will talk about that at the very end of the presentation. Briefly, I'm going to introduce myself to you. I think it's important that you know who I am and what my experiences are. I'm going to share some research that Dr. Ann Korn, who is now retired from Vanderbilt University, and myself did in 2002, which really gave us an opportunity to talk to 162 adults who are non-drivers around the country. I'm going to describe the video Reclaiming Independence. If all my technology works, we're going to actually hear two audio clips from it. And then I'm going to talk to you about the resource guide that accompanies the video. Both the video and the resource guide would be wonderful tools for affiliates to use within your support group meetings as you talk about this topic, because I know it is such an important one. Okay, a little bit about who I am. I was born in New Jersey, so if we have any affiliates from the Monmouth County, New Jersey area, maybe you even remember Howe Auto Driving School. You see on the slide a picture of a newspaper page and a gentleman standing in front of a car, and the titles about student drivers. My father ironically started a driving school long before I was born, and it was kind of ironic that he ended up with a daughter who is a non-driver due to congenital cataracts and nystagmus. So my dad literally taught, about half my graduating high school class of 400 students how to drive, but he couldn't legally teach me. So I've been a non-driver all my life, which I know is different than the experiences of most of you who are listening to this, and you're saying, well, you know, she hasn't driven, you know, she doesn't know what it's like to give up the car keys. You're right about that, but however, I have the same experiences. How am I going to get to the grocery store? Gee, today I'd really like to go on a hike, and I don't have a car to get there. So though I've never legally driven a car, I very much live the life of a non-driver each and every day. There are four pictures here I just briefly want to describe. One is of me in front of an ATM machine in my bicycle clothes, and I ride my bike about 3,500 miles a year, and I do many, many errands on it on a regular basis, usually about two a day. So big mode of transportation for me is the bike. Below that is a picture of a gentleman at the back of his pickup truck, and he has the cover opened up, and he has a blue piece of paper in his hand. This is my husband illustrating for you that he has many, many errands to run for the wife and a large pickup truck to put all the contents in. Next to that picture is a picture of a SunTran bus. SunTran's our local bus company, and I probably ride the bus about 3 days a week, and that's another method I use of independent travel as a non-driver. The picture above that is kind of a unique one. It's the back of a taxi cab with a bicycle hanging out of the trunk and me standing in a dress with a big white bag. And I use this picture to illustrate that sometimes I have to be very creative in my transportation. As part of my job at the university, I supervise student teachers. Sometimes I ride my bike to see them. Sometimes I take a cab, and in this case, I combine the two. I didn't want to get all, it was hot, it was May here in Tucson, I didn't want to get all hot and sweaty getting to the school and not look professional, so I took the bike along, and when I was done with the professional part, so to speak, of my morning, I put on my Lycra and took off on my bus to save the environment and save myself some money by riding my bike. As you well know from your own experience, there is a growing number of older adults who are visually impaired, and I have for you a short quote here. Quote, assuming no miracle cure, the number of severely visually impaired older persons will increase from 2 million in 1980 to about 3.2 million in 2000 to 4.6 million in 2020, and that's from Cruise 1991. And folks, we're well on our way to reaching that 4.6 million. I have up here four pictures, and the title says, Through the Eyes of Older Visually Impaired Adults. Many adults, as you have experienced yourself, experience a gradual vision loss. It's not a one day I could see fine and the next day I couldn't see at all, but it's a gradual experience with macular degeneration, glaucoma, diabetic retinopathy, cataracts, you name it. You know, if we look at the big five for folks over the age of 60, these are gradual conditions. So the sign might be blurred out. There's the street light, you might not see whether it's green or red until you're a little closer. You get the big arrow to see that, yeah, there's some kind of construction going on, but you might not see where that construction worker is that's waving traffic on. You have to get closer to those big green signs that tell you when you need to merge, and just those extra couple seconds to bring that sign into focus can make a difference. And then the picture that I know for many folks as I talk to them around the country, the child running out in front of the car. Do you have the reaction time to see that child, process what you're seeing, and stop safely? Many older adults really struggle with these issues as they begin to make that transition. They don't want to give up their independence, but are they really safe? When older adults stop driving, a couple things happen, and I've got a couple quotes I'm going to read to you here. Stopping driving is the first step towards a downward spiral towards dependency, and that's Horowitz, 2001. Many, many people have this feeling. I'm going to be so dependent on others, and I'm going to be so depressed. And so they hold on to those car keys much longer than they should hold on to those car keys. Another quote, Many studies have demonstrated that visual impairment in older individuals is associated with dependency on others, reduced physical activity, social isolation, and even mortality. Rubin 2000. And I really have to say, there are many people for whom that second quote about isolation is very true. When Dr. Korn and I did the study I'm about ready to talk to you about, in 2002, we reported our results. I had a graduate student who called, helped call 162 adults to do these phone interviews, and she talked to a man in the Dakotas who literally, except to go to church in the doctor's office, had not left his house in 7 years. And when she explained to him that he had options, he didn't believe her. And she said, you know, he told her he used to play golf all the time. She said, there's a blind golfing association. He thought she was full of it. As a matter of fact, she was so upset afterwards that she almost quit working on the project because she couldn't believe how isolated this man had made himself. So my message to you today, and by being here I know you well know, is your life can and will go on as a non-driver. There are many proactive things you can do, and I hope through the course of this presentation you'll begin to realize all the options out there. Okay. Dr. Korn and Dr. Sachs did a study in the Journal of Visual Impairment and Blindness back in 94, and they talked to working age adults. And I'm not going to go into that study right now, but that led to Dr. Korn getting really interested in saying, hey, to help working age adults be prepared to be non-drivers, we've got to do something with kids. And so her and I wrote a curriculum called Finding Wheels in 2000. When that curriculum came out, people were like, well, great, good, thank you so much, Dr. Korn, thank you so much, Dr. Rosenblum, but, you know, you're not addressing the big group, the over 55 crowd. And so Dr. Korn and I both are non-drivers. Let me rephrase that. Initially both started out as non-drivers. Dr. Korn in her late 30s, I believe, or early 40s, became a bioptic driver. So she is now a low-vision driver and is in her 50s. And Dr. Korn and I decided to do a research study. I'm going to go briefly through that study for you, which appeared in three articles in the Journal of Visual Impairment and Blindness. In that study, we looked at 162 adults who shared their experiences as being non-drivers. They represented 31 states, were about equally split on being men and women. 50%, like most of you listening today, had macular degeneration. 52% were diagnosed with their visual impairment after age 60. They broke out as far as age groups go pretty evenly between 60 to 69-year-olds, 70 to 79-year-olds, and over 80. Now, unfortunately, 90% of the folks that we talked to were Caucasian. And so one of the drawbacks of the study was we really did not get a well-representative sample of different ethnic groups in the country. Okay. Most of the people, 91%, did not have another disability. So the reason they truly stopped driving was because of the visual impairment. And about half of them had been diagnosed with after the age of 60. Now, it's important to know that 61% of these folks were still able to read regular print. Only 10% of them were blind. So most of these folks had some good usable vision. Okay. So we asked them about how they initially made the decision to stop driving. And almost 70% of them, 69%, made that decision themselves. 15% were told by the doctor. So very few doctors intervening. And only a couple, 4%, had an accident, and only 3% actually had the state that they lived in pull their license. Okay. Now, what really perplexed Dr. Korn and I as we did the study was that 3 out of 4 of the people, okay, so, you know, well over 100 people, 3 out of 4 of these 162 people, said in their communities there were alternative transportation options, whether it was bus, mass transit, bus, train, subway, whether it was paratransit. Those are, most of us think of those as the little vans that you call that provide transportation for the disabled and elderly, go by many different names in different communities. And only 1 in 3 people use these options. So 75% of the people had taxis, public transportation, or paratransit, but only 1 in 3, okay, only 33% of our people used it. So there was a big gap between what was there and what people used. One of our respondents said, I wish the public would be more aware of blindness. Taking the bus is more than getting off and on. It's difficult for visually impaired individuals. And I think this is very true. You have to have good orientation and mobility skills. That is the ability to know where you are in space and to travel there safely to be able to take that bus. Yeah, most of us have no problem sitting on the bus, but getting to the bus stop, finding the address we need to go to when we get off, and let alone as we get older, starting to have some problems with stamina. So bus riding isn't for everybody, and we're well aware of that, but there are options. Okay, one option is to hire a driver, to actually pay somebody to drive you. It doesn't have to be a taxi. Okay, most people did not do that. Only 20% of the people hired a driver. Okay, but many, many people reciprocated for rides. Okay, by reciprocation we mean, hey, you give me a ride, I'll do something nice for you. 73% bought food for people. That's one of my favorites. Anybody want to go get ice cream with me afterwards? Let me know if you're in Tucson. Okay, 51% bought gas for the driver. And sometimes people bartered, about 25% bartered. I'll watch your pets while you're out of town if you'll take me grocery shopping. You know, I'll make dinner for you once a week, those types of things. And as you wouldn't be surprised at all, for most people, even though they were non-drivers, a car was still the most common method they used to complete everyday tasks. Obviously, somebody was driving that car, most often a family member or a friend. Now, I know it's hard to believe, especially when somebody's making the transition to non-driving, but our respondents did tell us that there are some advantages to being a non-driver. That you don't have the stresses of traffic. One quote, much less stress than being a low-vision driver. Another, and I think this is a really important one, especially in our economy today, the idea of saving money. I don't have to pay for a car. If I had you guys in a workshop for a longer period of time, we would do an activity, and I'll describe this activity to you briefly and encourage you to do it in an affiliate meeting. And that is, I ask everybody to write down, thinking about if they're driving now, maybe they still own a car with their spouse or a family member, or went the last time they drove. I ask people to write down these expenses, thinking about a typical month. What's your car payment? Approximately how much do you pay on gas that month? Think about your registration licensing. Divide that amount for the year by 12. What do you pay on average a month for that? Think about the maintenance you had over the last year or the last year you owned the vehicle. Divide that by 12. What's your average maintenance that you have? Okay. When you add up all the, and also do the same thing for insurance. When you add all of that up, the average person in the workshops I have been doing around the country is spending between $700 and $1,200 per month to drive a car. So the next time you think, my gosh, it's $25 to take a cab to the beach, I really want to walk on the beach, think about that. If you take a cab each way and you spend $50, and on average you used to spend $700 a month for your car, okay, you're down $50. It still gives you $650 for taxis, for paying people meals, for paying to take the bus, to pay $2 or $3 each way to ride paratransit. Most people who are non-drivers spend a lot less money on transportation than do drivers. Okay, idea of freedom. An advantage, and you're saying freedom, no, Penny, that should be a disadvantage. But this person said, I don't have to be the designated driver. And again, think about it. If you enjoy going out and having a few drinks with your buddies, you're not going to be the designated driver when you're the non-driver. Companionship. Sometimes you get to see your friends more often when you go places with them. And then the increase in activity. Some people become healthier as a result of non-driving because they're walking more. They're walking to the store. They're walking to the bus stop. Now, nobody's going to argue with me and argue with our 162 respondents that, yes, there are disadvantages. There are many of them, and they fell into several categories. Probably the biggest is loss of spontaneity. Quote, I can't go when I want to go. I can't just hop in my car. Loss of independence, that idea of having to depend on someone else. Another area, loss of control, and another quote, I always have to be ready on time, and some drivers are late. I always tell people when you become a non-driver, you better learn to carry something with you to do, whether it's your MP3 player to listen to a book on tape, whether it's a book to read, whether it's some knitting or needlework to do, whether it's your cell phone to call and talk to the grandkids. Have a backup plan of something to do because you are going to be waiting. No two ways about it. Loss of social connections. Being a non-driver for many, many people takes them out of that opportunity to get with people that they see regularly. And that's why this whole idea of thinking creatively and still being independent. And then that idea of difficulty with emotions. Getting over the pride and asking for help is one of the respondents in the study said. Okay, our participants in the study had worries. Some of them were not getting where I want to go, losing my independence, and being a burden to others. And basically, they worried before they became a non-driver, and they worried as they were still non-drivers. So the reality is, I'm not going to tell you it's rosy. You are going to have some worries. One of the folks said, I got frustrated when there is something I really want to do, especially concerts. I gave up a lot of activities, beaches, etc. My lifestyle changed. It's lonely. And what I want to say to all of you today, and what I say to people of any age group who stop driving for any reason or are unable to drive because of vision loss, is you have a choice in how lonely it gets. Yes, there are always going to be things that you want to do that you don't get to do, but you can make many, many things happen for yourself if you start to think outside the box and if you build a skill set. Okay, our participants in the study gave advice. These fell into several categories. One was proactive statements. The first and biggest, get mobility training. Orientation and mobility training is a key to success to being a non-driver. Make your plans and requests known to family or friends. In other words, you really have to have effective communication skills. And I think that's essential to being visually impaired in general, but being a non-driver in particular. If you don't describe to people what you need, what's difficult for you, what you can do for yourself, if you don't have good communications, you're going to have issues in all areas, not just in the non-driving area. One of our people said something about acceptance. Accepted. It's not terminal. And I think that's very, very true. You are going to get through this transition. Personal attributes, the idea of trying to be more flexible in your life. There were a lot of advice to future non-drivers around personal emotions, helping them to recognize there will be a grieving process. And also some of our respondents gave thoughts of hope and encouragement. One of them said it becomes easier after a while. And I think that's very true. That it does become easier. The more strategies you learn, the more experience you have. So we did this study, okay? We actually collected the data in, mostly in 2000, a little bit into 2001. We had to write about it. We had to get it in a journal. And we kept saying, well, what's the product? You know, great. You publish it, who reads it? So we wanted to make something, and so we started to think about making a video because we really had some findings that we felt people needed to know. One of the findings that we wanted to make sure came out, and we wanted these points to come out in our video, that as individuals make the transition from driver to non-driver, they need to support to learn new skills, how to use different transportation options, how to work through the emotional aspects of non-driving. It's tough, folks, to go it alone. That's why you found your way to the support groups that you're in. We also found out that people need to develop self-advocacy skills and proactive ways to ask for assistance, especially if you've been a person who hasn't been good about asking for help, letting people know what you're thinking and feeling. You're going to have a hard time with that. Another thing we found is that families and friends need information. It's not just the non-driver who needs information, but the families and friends need information about how they can help. We want to make sure our product addressed that. Professionals can provide non-drivers connections to mentors. We felt it was really important that people realize by making connections as you are with the affiliates that you're involved with, that you can find other people who have walked in front of you, so to speak. So with this study underway and completed, Dr. Korn and I really felt we had sown some seeds, so to speak, to develop a video and a resource guide to support older adults in making the transition. I very much want to describe the picture to you that's on the screen. Shortly, you're going to get to hear the voice of Gary and the other five, what we call stars in our video, Reclaiming Independence. I talked to 50 older adults at least around the country to select the six people to be in this video. Gary was one of the first people selected. He is a farmer. He was a farmer in North Dakota, farming three generations in the family. And when I interviewed him on the phone about the possibility of being in the video, he told me about when he first had to stop driving, but he used to go out in the barn and lock himself in there and hang out with the tractor. He'd walk around it, he'd sit on it, he'd pretend he was still driving it. And, you know, it was like losing a family member for him to lose that tractor. He eventually ended up selling it. And so there's a picture here of Gary walking next to a tractor. He's got his cane in his left hand. He's got his right hand on the wheel of the tractor. So Dr. Korn and myself went to the American Printing House for the Blind and said, hey, can we work with you to develop a video? We decided that the target audience would be such as yourselves, older non-drivers. As I said, we identified six stars. I call them the stars. Six people who are the focus of the video who shared their experiences. And then we wanted to make sure that the video talked about four things: transportation, orientation and mobility, low vision, and vision rehabilitation therapy. We didn't want to just have people say, oh, this is how I do it, this is my story, but we wanted to make sure that people who watched the video realized that there are services out there that they could access to be successful non-drivers. Now, we picked six adults throughout the United States, and we literally went coast to coast. We balanced for many, many, many things, including age. Okay, we run from 50 to 80. Gender, we have three women, three men. Ethnicity, shortly I'm going to play a little bit of the introduction of the video and you'll hear the people. Wilbert is African American and Johnny is Hispanic, and the other four people you'll meet in the video are Caucasian. Two of our folks in the video are totally blind. The rest have some low vision. Wilbert is a veteran. We wanted to make sure we represented the VA medical system. I will describe to you in a little bit as I talk to you about each person that you'll see that they got very different services. We go from Maine to Florida to Colorado. We made sure that we had some folks in urban areas, some folks in rural areas, and some folks in suburban areas. A couple of our folks were married. They varied in the transportation they used and the family support they had. And most importantly, we were looking for personality. And I think even just in the short little clip you're going to hear in just a second, that you're going to hear the personality come through. So what I'm going to do now, I have the video on my laptop. I realize that we are not able to see it. But basically, at this point in the video, I have previously done a very short introduction. And each of the six stars, as I call them, are going to tell you a little bit about themselves and why they gave up driving. So what you would be seeing on the video are close-ups of their faces as they tell you in their own voices why they stopped driving. You'll hear me as the narrator introduce each person and say their name and their age. So I'm going to be quiet here for just a minute, and we're going to get this video up for you. So.
Johnny Herrera, age 60, Denver, Colorado.
When I first developed diabetes, I went to the doctor. I didn't want to tell nobody that I was having problems driving, but one day I almost ran over a guy in the parking lot, and I didn't see him, and I know I didn't see him.
Sid Clayton, age 78, Tucson, Arizona.
I've lost all of the sight in my right eye, except for one little slit. The left eye, I have probably 40% of my sight. I just knew that I would be a danger on the street with not being able to see peripherally. And it was awful because I had a new convertible.
Gary Bornson, age 56, Inkster, North Dakota.
The last day I drove, they were actually loading a semi of potatoes, and I just couldn't see inside the truck or anything else. And on the way home, you know, it was a struggle to see corners. I just said, can't do this anymore.
Blanche Sterling, age 87, Miami, Florida.
And I found I was pulling up to a corner. I couldn't read the blasted street sign. I got out a flashlight, and I'm this crazy woman at the side of the road flashing it up at the sign to tell me where I'm at, because I was got myself lost. The thought crossed my mind, you're going to have to give up driving. Is it going to be any easier next year after you cream the car and maybe kill yourself? Or is it the time now to face the decision, hang up the car keys, and get on with what you can do with what you've got?
Wilbert Clark, age 51, Dale City, Virginia.
My vision impairment was caused by my diabetes being out of control, and it was hard for me to see things at night. I can't see long distance. I had an accident one time that told me that it's time for you to stop driving.
Josephine Swan, age 81, Swan's Island, Maine.
Well, things were getting a little hazy, dimmer, going into a place where there was shadow. I couldn't see what was there. I could hit someone and not know it. I knew things weren't going right. I just put the car in my daughter's yard, and I won't be driving anymore.
Okay, so you got to hear a little bit of their voices and got introduced to the stars. I'm going to take about a minute per star just to tell you a little bit about each of them. And I should explain, the way the video is laid out is after the introductory piece that you just heard, we talk a little bit about the different kinds of services out there. Well, first we talk a little bit about family. We have a couple family members who talk. Then we talk about the different kinds of services. And then for about 20 minutes of the 40-minute video, we take each star and we visit them in their community and travel with them to see the type of things that they do and the transportation they use. So Josephine is the first person that we visit in the video. I have four pictures up on the screen. I'm going to describe each of them very briefly and tell you a little bit about Josephine. Josephine in the first picture is standing in front of a little gray clapboard house, and it's actually on the island of Swan's Island, Maine, which has a population of about 300 people. The only way on and off the island is to take a ferry. And so Josephine will arrange for a neighbor or a family member to give her a ride to the ferry. Then she takes the ferry across the ocean, I believe it is, to the town where it lands. And the second picture I have up on the screen is a little van pulling up. And Josephine has researched it and found out that several communities will send little vans on certain days of the week to meet the ferry. And so she's able to go to doctor's appointments, to stores, using these little vans. And not every community sends a van every day, so she's figured out on Mondays is the van that goes to the Walmart town, on Wednesdays is the van that goes to the town where her doctor is. Another picture shows Josephine meeting with her vision rehabilitation therapist. Most of you probably are more familiar with the term rehab teacher. And they were doing a little lesson, and so she's looking at some tools. And the final picture is probably one of my favorite shots in the video. And it is showing Josephine out for a walk along a country road on her island with the ocean and boats behind her. So Josephine is in a very rural community. Gary is also in a very rural community, and there are now four pictures of Gary up on the screen. One of them shows Gary walking down a country road with his cane, and there's nothing around him but crops growing, and that's all there is. Okay. Gary and his wife live on, I want to say, about 20 acres currently, and so you see a picture of him standing in front of the barn, and that's actually where he talked to us for his interview. And pretty much when he's home, there's nowhere for him to walk. There's no stores to walk to. There's no neighbor's house to walk to. The last 8 miles to his house are down a dirt road. Okay, the next picture of Gary is with the tractor I told you about. And the last picture of Gary is actually at a keyboard, and he has JAWS on his computer, which is a screen reading program probably many of you are familiar with, and we have him demonstrate that in the video. But Gary tells a story of losing his vision to diabetes and for sitting at home for several years, finally contacting the state vocational rehab and getting some training as a computer programmer, spending some time looking for a job, and then finally getting a job. But the way he gets to his job, which is in the town that's an hour away, is his wife takes him. So in the video, his wife talks for a few minutes about that she doesn't always want to be the driver, but unfortunately she is the driver, that there is no choice. So Gary has really found visual impairment to restrict him. He doesn't go fishing or to the bar as much as he used to because he has to make arrangements with somebody else to go. So he lacks the spontaneity and very much is dependent on his wife. So he approaches rural living differently than Josephine, who's become very independent in spite of living on an island where the only way off is a ferry. Okay, Wilbert lives in suburbia, and we're now seeing some pictures of Wilbert. One of them is Wilbert going to get into a taxi cab, and he will routinely call taxi cabs and use them to get around the community. In the video, he's shown at the bank doing some banking with the taxi. He's also shown waiting for the bus in the picture and getting off the bus. He can ride a bus into Washington, D.C., which is about 20 miles away. He can ride buses to other communities. He's very independent. He can walk up the street, and there are some stores he can access. And then there's also a picture of Wilbert using a magnifying glass, looking at a book with his granddaughter, who's about 10 years of age. And Wilbert's wife really talks about the importance of family, and Wilbert talks about how he's still able to do things with his granddaughter. Wilbert also talks about how he accessed the VA Medical Center to get the orientation and mobility training, the low vision training. And we have Tom Miller of the Blinded Veterans Association talk a little bit about that. Sid, like Wilbert, lives in a fairly suburban community. She was in Tucson, Arizona. And we see Sid walking in the botanical gardens and sitting on a bench. She's out, she's enjoying herself, and she travels using buses, using taxis, using paratransit. We actually have a picture of her getting on the paratransit, the little van for people who are elderly or disabled. And in the video, she talks very much about how she schedules her paratransit for the week. She also talks about her wonderful grandson and how he will call her up about once a week and say, "Hey, Graham, do you want to do something?" And basically he's saying, "Can I help you?" And so there's a picture of them going into a grocery store. And I have to say that her grandson is just a wonderful young man. Both of them told us that when they do the shopping and the running around, afterwards they come home and they play poker. So we have a very nice scene of them playing poker together. Blanche lives in an even more urban community than Sid and Wilbert. She lives in Miami in the Kendall area. I saw somebody is listed on here as being Kendall, so I'm not sure if you're Kendall, Miami. But if you are, Blanche receives services at the Miami Lighthouse. And she's our oldest person. She's 87. And she talks a lot about what a difficult transition it was for her to become a non-driver. And we see her using a CCTV, using a needle threader, and then getting off a paratransit van. Our last person who lives in a very urban area is Johnny. Johnny is a very supportive wife. We see him pictured with her and his son. We see him and his son playing golf. And they both talk to us about how they don't play golf so competitively anymore, that his son is much more of a help. Johnny uses a lot of different transportation options. We see him at the train station buying a train ticket. He'll take the bus anywhere all over Denver. He loves to take it to a guitar store, and he'll sit there and play guitar. So he has found alternative ways. He walks several miles a day, and he has no problem getting where he needs to go. As I mentioned, there's a resource guide that accompanies the video. It's a lot more detailed information to help people get more information about the different topics. It comes in many formats, including large print, audio files, and Braille. There are colored pictures throughout it to illustrate the key points. Now, the resource guide itself is divided into several sections. The first section helps people understand their own visual impairments, their own eye condition. What does legal blindness mean? How do you talk to your eye doctor? How do you talk to your family? There's also in a section in there about dealing with the Department of Motor Vehicle. The second section talks about the different types of services, clinical low vision, rehabilitation therapy, orientation and mobility, assistive technology. And so people who are not familiar with those services can get information about them and learn about them. The third section really focuses on the different forms of transportation people have seen the stars, as I call them, using, including the paratransit, the taxis. It also includes a section about using long-distance travel options, such as trains and airplanes. Okay. The final section helps people find resources in their community, how to locate rehabilitation services, how to locate folks that give clinical low vision evaluations, finding out about different transportation options in your community, and then blindness-related organizations and aging-related organizations. So there are many ideas for using the resource guide. One option is to use it within support groups, such as yourselves, for agencies that serve adults with vision loss to use it, We'd love to see this in the hand of eye doctors, eye care specialists, at senior centers, and at social work. People can take the resource guide home and read it individually, read it with their family. Again, use it in a support group, use it in a more formal setting. You've all been provided a copy of the flyer, and so I've just pasted in the PDF of the flyer here that tells you how to get the video from the American Printing House for the Blind. And that video is available on federal quota. So if you are with an agency and you are receiving federal quota from the American Printing House for the Blind, you can request this. Otherwise, the cost is $60, and that is for the DVD and for the resource guide that come packaged as a set. I'm ready, Ed, if you are, to go ahead and go to questions. So I'm going to go ahead and unmute myself here.
Okay, that sounds good. Thank you, Dr. Rosenblum. I appreciate that presentation. One of the questions that came in earlier that I definitely want to get to, because this is near and dear to my heart, Dr. Rosenblum, I practice low vision 100% in West Central Florida, and meet a lot of people that need or want bioptic telescopes for driving. Lyon Center for the Blind in Oakland said, will DMV policies be discussed and the use of bioptic telescopes? Can you address that and hit the main details on that for us?
We really didn't discuss that in the video and the resource guide as far as that topic goes specifically. I will say from other work I have done that it's a very much an individualized process. It's very important that people go through the right steps, have a very thorough clinical low vision evaluation if they meet the criteria to drive with bioptics, to go through good training program that has knowledgeable folks that can really make sure that people have the skills. There are many people who drive very successfully with bioptics, including Dr. Ann Korn, and I think it's a very viable option that should be explored by everybody who has low vision and meets the visual criteria, but there's a lot more to it than just meeting the visual criteria, as I'm sure you know.
Okay, and Lyon Centers for the Blind, what do you recommend to someone who feels they can still drive, but their doctor is advising them against it?
I really would recommend that they think about listening to their doctor, that they also check in with people they trust, family members and friends, and that they consider maybe going to a driving school that has some experience and sign up and take a lesson with a driver educator to ask that person to evaluate whether or not they feel that they're safe. Again, if most people have been driving for 20, 30, 40, 50, 60 years, they may not be picking up on these gradual decreases in vision and may not realize that they really are putting themselves at risk, and more importantly, they're putting other people at risk. So if your doctor is saying you shouldn't be driving, you really need to take that to heart, and if you feel you need another opinion, get another medical opinion, and then also consider, like I said, contacting a driver's education school, signing up for a driver's lesson, not to learn how to drive, but to ask that professional to give you an opinion about what they're seeing when you're behind the wheel.
Yeah, absolutely. I know I come across patients on a routine basis that I come at the situation in a very humble way, because I'm talking to people that are 20, 30, 40 years my senior, and they have been driving sometimes even that longer than I've been alive without an accident, and I'm telling them that I don't feel they should drive. And I know they don't understand, and I really saying it with a loving way, but it's more than just the history of not having an accident. Certainly there's not only the visual acuity, but what I'm looking at is their visual field, which may sometimes, in a lot of studies, have shown even as a better indicator of how safe someone would be in driving. A more wide visual field certainly is helpful. And sometimes even more than that, what can be important is what's known as contrast sensitivity, just that ability to see detail under different lighting conditions. Anything you want to add to that?
I 100% agree with you, having some personal experiences in my own family right now with who should and shouldn't be driving at this point, because some family members are starting to observe changes. So as we age, our eyes change. That ability to see light or to see clearly, we need more light. Everything's so gradual that people just may not recognize that it really is getting near time to think about getting off the road before, you hurt yourself or you hurt somebody else. And it's not just the acuity issue, as you said. The contrast is a huge issue. The visual fields, things kind of sneaking in on you. You don't see that car that's pulling out on your right side until you're almost upon it. So I would really encourage people to err on the side of caution. There's so much complexity to driving a car. And if you're starting to feel nervous, if you're starting to say, you know, I don't make left turns anymore unless I'm at a lighted intersection where I have an arrow. If you're starting to find yourself going around the block to avoid those places, it may be time to really start thinking about making the transition to non-driving. Because if we're saying, as these six wonderful adults in the video share, there is light at the end of the tunnel. You can be a very successful non-driver, so why push the envelope?
Yeah, absolutely. I had actual face-to-face experience with a situation like this. I actually was involved in a head-on accident, totaled my car about 6 years ago with a driver who actually had been taken off the road due to a visual impairment, and unfortunately we were both hurt, not seriously. I'm still here to talk about it, but I certainly take it to heart as far as that goes. I think one of the worst cases I've seen with a visual impairment and wanting to drive was a gentleman that literally was almost totally blind, actually. And when I asked him how he came into the office, he said he drove and was pretty indignant about it. When I asked him, how does he actually see? Because he couldn't even see, well, not only the E, but I don't think he even saw the wall that the E was projected on. He said that when he pulled out onto a road, he actually just counted six shadows, and then he pulled out. So actually, we kept him there at the office until we could get the highway patrol out to the office there for him, just to, for his safety and everyone else's. We have an affiliate that sent in a question that says, I have a resident who would like to know, how do I know when it is really time to give up driving? One key factor.
When you're starting to ask that question, that's the key factor. If you're starting to think, boy, should I still be doing this? Right there, as you start to question yourself, that's a big indication. I would say another indication is that if you find yourself restricting yourself, I won't go out when it's dark at night. I don't want to drive when it's dark at night. Starting to plan that grocery store trip for early Sunday morning when there's less traffic on the road. Those types of things are indicators that, you know, you're starting to question your ability to be out there and to be safe. Obviously, another one is if you go to see your eye doctor and your eye doctor is telling you that you have a significant decrease in acuity or visual field, that's an indicator. If your children, your grandchildren, your neighbors are saying things, if somebody's saying to you, you know what, I'd rather drive, I don't feel safe when you're driving, that's a huge red light. So it can be come at you from many different ways, but I would say each person who has a visual impairment, each person who's aging and doesn't have a visual impairment but is just beginning to age, needs to start asking themselves, am I really safe out there? And the question that I often say to people is, if you have a child, a grandchild, niece and nephew, how are you going to feel if you hurt or kill that child because you didn't see him run out to get his ball out of the street or pull out on his bike? If you don't feel that you'd be able to see that and you might hurt a child, then you don't belong on the road.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree totally. Dr. Rosenblum, I'd love to hear your comments if you have some experience with just a wide variety of levels of vision that's acceptable through the Department of Motor Vehicles throughout the states. Here in Florida, your vision has to be between 20/40 to 20/70. And I know there are states like California, you basically can be almost legally blind and be able to drive. It's just amazing the lack of standardization and the variety of actual acceptable levels from state to state.
And it definitely does vary from state to state, and I have found that myself as well. In doing a little bit of research, that I think we're moving towards eventually a national standard, because, you know, I've seen that happen here in Arizona. Before we became a state where people could drive with bioptics, people would go to California, get a P.O. box, and get a license in California, because, as you said, the acuity, you don't have to have a fair amount of the significant vision loss and still get licensed to drive in California. Arizona, it's 2050. So every state is different, and the variability concerns me. I'm going to ask Ed and Dan here, if we don't have any more questions coming in from affiliates, I thought I would maybe go back to the video and just play about another 2 minutes of it, if you think that would be okay.
Absolutely. Let's go ahead and take one last question we have here, and then let's go ahead and do that. I have Paul asking, what are your feelings regarding riding a bike or Segway instead of driving? And I want to add to that, let's add golf carts into that, because we have here in Florida, as I know they have in Arizona and California and probably some other states, what's called golf cart communities, where basically you can drive on roads, sometimes separate roads, with a golf cart, even with impairments, visual impairments. So if you can give us some feeling on that, your feelings regarding that, and then after that, let's go ahead and do what you suggested there, and then we'll wrap it up.
Well, I have to say, being a biker, I ride my bicycle, as I said in my intro, about 3,500 miles every year, and I always tell people, when it gets to the inevitable day when I get hit, I don't know whether it's going to be vehicular homicide or bicycle suicide, because I question each and every time I go out there whether I belong out there. I, as a low-vision person who rides my bike, take a lot of precautions. I go on routes that I'm very familiar with. If I have to go on a new place in my city, I get somebody to preview that route with me. I try to really watch the time of day I go. I try to go when there is less traffic out there. I think the same questions that folks need to ask themselves about, should I be behind the wheel of a car, apply to, should I be on a bike, a Segway, or a golf cart. If I have any question whatsoever about my ability to be safe myself and or to keep others around me safe, then this may not be a good option. However, for many people, bikes, Segways, golf carts are a very viable option, because they go a lot slower. As you said, sometimes there are restricted areas where there aren't going to be motor vehicles. So, you know, I don't want to say, well, when you can't drive a car, go get a golf cart. Again, I think you need to continually question, and you need to talk to the people around you who see you driving your golf cart to ask them, hey, you know, you got any concerns about me? And if somebody does share a concern with you, you need to not dismiss it. You need to take it to heart. I wanted to end by letting you once again hear from our six stars briefly and the advice they give to others who are considering non-driving.
Like Johnny and the other non-drivers you have met, you too can continue doing the things you enjoy. Here is some advice they offer for reclaiming your independence as a non-driver.
My advice to new non-drivers or people that are vision impaired or slowly losing their sight, go ahead and stop. You know, don't fool yourself, because you can end up hurting yourself or someone else, or even worse, the ultimate, kill yourself.
You start not to see, it's time that you let your ego go and your pride and let somebody else take over the driving. Because not only is somebody's life at stake, your life is at stake too.
Speak up and ask for the help you need. Express your need, because I have never found a person yet that wouldn't respond to your need if expressed courteously and clearly, so they understand what you're looking for. You can do the things that I can do, get over it, and move on. I've done it.
When you lose your sight and go blind or visually impaired, you really have two choices. You either quit and give up, or you get off your butt and go and do something. We can be productive. We just have to, you have to have it in you to want to do it.
I think that we should seek help any place we can find it, and then pass it on.
Okay. I think the advice Sid gives at the end is really the message I want to leave you with. You don't have to do this alone. Seek out the resources in your community. Seek out the resources in your own personal network. And seek out organizations such as this wonderful one that you're a part of. And all the best to you in making that transition to being an independent non-driver. It can be done, and I know you can do it. So thank you for having me today.
Dr. Rosenblum, thank you so much. We appreciate your time and expertise in sharing that with us and the thousands of people around the world. We also want to thank everyone that participated today. Thank you for being there in all your different places and sitting through the presentation and submitting your questions. We also want to thank the Macular Degeneration Foundation, which is www.eyesight.org, and Macular Degeneration Research, www.ahaf.org. Also want to mention we look forward to seeing everyone next month on February 12th. The schedule has Ellen Troyer, the Chief Research Officer at BioCentrix, giving us a great presentation on body weight and eye disease. So that's it from me. I just want to say keep looking up. And Dan?
Thank you, Dr. Ed Huggett, Dr. Penny Rosenblum, and especially our group facilitators all over the world. We're not able to do this without you, so your dedication is greatly appreciated. Best wishes to everybody for the new year, and always remember to take good care of yourselves and each other.